We're heading into the final week of Parliament for the year. The government wants to finish with a win by passing its overhaul of environment laws. Susan Lee wants to survive what's known as the killing season. I'm David Spears. Welcome to Insiders. As we head into the final days of Parliament for the year, Susan Lee is confident she's done enough to survive. The opposition leader's been blitzing the airwaves, trying to convince voters dumping the net zero emissions target is a good idea. Most senior Liberals are also playing down the prospects of any challenge in this final week. It's a different story at the state level. New South Wales and Victorian Liberals have just installed new leaders, both women, who plan to stick with net zero. For the government, this week is about one thing, passing a new set of environment laws. And there's movement this morning. We'll bring you details shortly of a concession Labor is offering the Greens on native forest logging. No luck for the government, however, when it comes to hosting next year's global climate summit. Australia has pulled out of the race, giving Turkey the rights to host COP31. As part of the deal, however, Chris Bowen will lead negotiations.
Australia and Turkey remain locked in a standoff, with both countries refusing to back down.
Turkey is chosen. We wouldn't seek to veto that.
Hey, how you going?
Australia has bowed out of the race.
COP31 will be hosted by Turkey.
The government really didn't fight very hard.
I'm disappointed that the federal government couldn't go the next step.
Chris Bowen would remain the head of negotiations in an unusual compromise.
Can Chris Bowen hold both the role of the top president and energy minister at the same time?
You bet he can.
Australians don't need a part-time energy minister.
The Prime Minister has let down the country.
His action domestically is also about action globally.
Susan Lee is offering to pass Labor's environmental law overhaul if the government can agree on several demands.
We are up for a sensible conversation about how to get this right.
If the Labor government wants any credibility, they've got to reject the laundry list from the coalition.
I'm extremely confident that we will pass these laws.
The opposition leader facing calls to reject the proposed reform, particularly from Nationals MPs.
There's a lot of concerns being raised.
If we can't pass the laws with one side, we'll do it with the other.
This is the time of year when opposition leaders in particular start looking over their shoulders.
A woman will lead the Victorian Liberal Party. Jess Wilson took over the reins this morning.
I'm a new generation of the Liberal Party.
Kelly Sloane's been elected as the new leader after it was vacated by Mark Speakman.
I'm not going to stand here and pretend that some of the dysfunction that we've seen over time federally won't impact us at state level.
I have faced the brand damage that has emanated from Canberra.
So it feels like he thinks this is your fault.
I don't think so at all, Pete.
Susan Lee's role as opposition leader still hangs in the balance.
We have a leader. Her name is Susan Lee.
Every single one of the moderates that I spoke to this morning supports Susan Lee as the leader.
She'll take us to the next election.
Susan Lee today on a media blitz.
I'm talking about my affordable, responsible energy plan,
which I'm carrying with me everywhere we go.
It is just a policy to try and get the Leader of the Opposition through to Christmas.
Can you guarantee the voters that the party will keep its first female leader until the next election?
Absolutely. I am the leader.
Well, my guest this morning is Greens Senator Sarah Hanson-Young. First, let's check what's making news. The government's offering the Greens a concession on native forest logging if it agrees to pass its overhaul of environment laws. Under a proposed amendment we can reveal this morning, native forest logging would have to comply with new national environmental standards within 3 years. Regional forestry agreements are currently exempt from federal environment laws. While the Greens want an immediate ban on native forest logging, a spokesperson for the Environment Minister says this move would mean a higher level of environmental protection. At the G20 in South Africa, leaders have issued a rebuke of Donald Trump, signing a joint statement strengthening their commitment to the Paris Climate Agreement and free trade. The ABC's Jane Norman reports the US president refused to attend this summit and has described the Paris Agreement as a hoax. State and territory leaders have issued a joint letter to the Prime Minister, warning thousands of patients will remain stranded in hospital beds unless he lifts support for aged care and the NDIS. News Corp papers report the leaders want the federal government to fulfil a promise to lift its hospital funding share. And finally, Cyclone Fina is now tracking down the coast away from Darwin after leaving some damage, including the partial collapse of a hospital roof. But fortunately, no injuries reported yet. We're going to start on the environment law overhaul, which the government wants passed urgently to speed up approval decisions on everything from renewables to mines and housing developments. Labor needs the support of either the Coalition or the Greens, and it wants both to know it's determined to cut a deal one way or another to get this done. The question for the Greens, will they take this morning's offer on native forest logging and stop Labor striking a deal with the Coalition? This offer is also clearly aimed at putting some pressure on the Coalition too to come to the party. Let's see what the panel makes of it. We're joined this week by Nikki Savva, Tom Crowley and Mark Kenny. Very good morning to all of you. Let's start on the environment law debate, which will be the dominant legislative issue this week. Nikki, when you look at the government's approach to this negotiation, it's got the two options this morning, offering a concession to the Greens. How do you think it's going in negotiating this at the moment?
Well, firstly, they are absolutely determined to do a deal this week. Murray Watt has had, I think, more than 100 meetings with individual stakeholders. He's been to Perth four or five times, and he believes, he is confident that he will be able to nail down a deal by, say, Wednesday night. The thing is, who will it be with? Will it be with the Greens or will it be with the Coalition? And strange as it seems to say, at this point, the Greens seem to be the more reliable dance partner. While the government believes that Susan Lee is desperate in a way to strike a deal, there is no confidence within the government that she would be able to deliver.
As in hold all the coalition?
As in hold all the coalition. You've already got Matt Canavan and Barnaby Joyce from the National Party saying you can't do any deal with the government on the environment, and there are also Conservative Libs who are saying they're not very sure about the deal that the government is offering. So Murray Watt is prepared to do it with either side. It depends who blinks or who buckles first, but at this stage,
yeah, and the Greens. And this morning's offer to the Greens, there was one yesterday too, when it comes to coal and gas projects not being approved under the new national interest power that the minister would have. It does look like they're serious about doing a deal with the Greens, or at least want the Coalition to think they're serious about doing a deal with the Greens. Tom, we should probably explain what this is all about. It's very complex. Don't want to go through the whole 1,500-page legislation.
I'll pull out the bill.
Yeah. But what essentially is this about, and where are the most important sticking points, I suppose?
Well, the process began really with this Samuel review talking about the fact that our environmental approvals framework wasn't doing a good enough job of protecting the environment. It's also become one, though, about time. Projects taking far too long to get approved, several years in some cases. It's a complex system. That's what business really want out of this. And so the government, in the end, has tried to bridge both gaps with, I think, you'd call it faster yeses and faster noes. So they're carving out some sections. They're saying we'll take some applications on bulk for similar types of applications. That's for the business, saying we can give you those faster yeses. Then as far as the faster noes, we'll have some new environmental standards, some scope for the minister to say that there's an unacceptable impact of this project from the get-go. We won't even consider your application. It'll get rejected. So that's about streamlining, but it's also then about the environmental toughness.
And for the first time, as part of that, a new national EPA, an Environment Protection Authority. There's a lot of argument between the Coalition and Labor over what powers it would have, the penalties it could issue and so on. But ultimately, it would still be the minister who has the power to approve projects.
That's right. And that's sort of been the key glue here for business in particular, the minister saying, look, we'll set up this new agency. It will have some involvement in the process. Exactly what that is still unsettled. Well, at least, you know, in terms of the conversation with the Coalition, but that ultimately the minister will sort of retain the power to make sensible decisions. And I guess you can kind of promise to everyone that those decisions will be whatever you want to tell them it will be.
Mark, I suppose for the Nats, who do sound a little more reserved about rushing any deal on this, if this speeds up decision, it speeds up the rollout of wind farms, solar farms, the sort of thing that the Nats are really wanting to slow down.
Yeah, that's right. And going to the original point you make there, having it done this year, that's still not really properly explained to anyone why such important legislation needs to be done this year. It seems like political convenience.
But if it's going to speed up the rollout of the renewables for the net zero transition or housing developments or critical minerals, you don't want this to take too long to...
You mean getting the bill through?
Getting the bill through so that you can then speed up
these
things.
Yeah, I know, but if we're talking about a matter of months, if we're talking about proper scrutiny of a very, as you said, 1,500 pages of bill, some pretty big implications associated with it, you want to get it right, I would have thought. So,
That's fair.
It has been years, though. I guess that's the other thing, is that this dragged on... Well, when Susan Lee was the Environment Minister, first of all, it's been years in the making, and I think there's a recognition from business and from Labor and the Coalition, and everyone just sort of wants to get this over and done with. I think from Labor's perspective as well, they made this implementation year. They wanted to get to the end of the year and be able to say we've cleared these barnacles away and we can focus on something new. So I think there are a few reasons to really want to get it done this year.
Well, I just don't find that very convincing if we're talking about a couple of months, really. I mean, that's what this Senate inquiry has scheduled, you know, a review that would report, I think, in March or something. So
I'm not
entirely sure why it needs to be hurried quite to that.
Well, certainly business groups are keen for this to be done, and they're very keen for the Coalition to do a deal with Labor rather than let Labor do a deal with the Greens. I spoke to Tanya Constable from the Minerals Council for the podcast this week.
We've been talking to the Coalition about making sure that those fundamental changes are there. So our clear view and message to all political parties is make sure that we can see this bill achieved in the shortest time possible so that we can get the changes that are needed for everybody concerned and for this country.
And look, for the Liberals, some of them acknowledge they need to do this deal for one good reason. After dumping net zero, they need to look like they've got some environmental credentials, that they're doing something that's going to help the environment. And Susan Lee is one of those who is sounding more positive about doing a deal.
We are up for a sensible conversation about how to get this right, because we do want to see projects with a shorter timeline than they have right now. We know there's a problem to be fixed. We sincerely hope the government will address that.
Yeah, there are risks, Nikki, for the Greens and the Coalition in not doing a deal here.
Exactly, for both sides. I mean, the Liberals now have to show at least some sign that they care about the environment. And the Greens, on the other hand, I think they paid a pretty big price at the May election for being seen to be too intransigent and too obstructionist. So I think they want to correct that a bit. So there's incentive for them to do a deal as well, which is why I think, you know, it is entirely possible that there will be a deal this year, that it will get passed. And I slightly agree with Mark that, you know, what's the hurry when it has dragged on for 5 years? And who knows whether if they delayed it until March, then it wouldn't drag on until the middle of the year or whatever. So there is a now or never feeling around the place in relation to this bill.
Well, time to talk to the Greens Senator, Sarah Hanson-Young, about all this. To take us there, here was the former Treasury boss, Ken Henry, who now chairs the Australian Climate and Biodiversity Foundation, as well as the Nature Finance Council. He spoke to us when this legislation was first unveiled.
It's a piece of legislation that I think faithfully delivers what was called for by Professor Graham Samuel when he wrote his review of the EPBC Act 5 years ago. I would say we've known for 15 years now that the laws have not been working to protect the environment.
Sarah Hanson-Young, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Dave.
I'll come to Ken Henry's view on why this legislation is better than the current set of laws that we have. But just first on this morning's offer from Murray Watt on native forest logging, what do you make of that?
Well, look, I think it's good to see the government putting some issues on the table that we've raised, that we've been talking to them about. We obviously have to go through the details of these things. We haven't seen any detailed amendments from the government or anything that kind of spells out exactly how this would work. But I've been working pretty hard to convince the government that we need to have more protections in this bill, because as it is, it actually is a step backwards. And rather than protecting our native forests, protecting our climate, it's all about fast-tracking projects. The whole point of the Environment Protection Act is to protect nature. And if we don't have a step forward for protecting nature, then it's failing to do its job. It just doesn't do what it says on the tin.
OK, and I will come back to whether this bill improves on the current set of laws that we have when it comes to nature. But you met yesterday with Murray Watt, as I understand it, and presumably he went through this native forest logging concession, a three-year transition for regional forestry agreements to comply with the new national environmental standards. Is that something you welcome?
Look, we will... You know, we'll talk about this when we see the details and when we, you know, when my party room's able to have a proper discussion.
But three more years
of the destruction of our native forests when we've got, 2,000 plus species already endangered in this country, where we've got billions of dollars of taxpayer money already being already spent subsidising an industry that's about destroying our native forests. I mean, it's 2025 and it's time we ended native forest logging, protected these beautiful ancient forests that aren't just there for the richness of biodiversity, but they're so important when it comes to combating climate change. They are carbon sinks. In fact, one of the easiest and fastest ways of helping Australia meet our emissions targets is by saving our native forests and stopping them being logged.
So you could suggest a shorter time frame for this transition then, instead of 3 years, 2 years, 1 year?
Look, I think the time frame, at first blush, I think, as I said, another 3 years of destroying our forests is pretty... I don't think in any way deals with the urgency of protecting our native forests now. But of course, we also then need to make sure what does the standards mean? What does meeting those standards? Mm. How do we actually make sure our forests are protected? That they're not just protected for the animals that live within them, but that they're protected for our climate. I mean, a lot of people would be shocked to know, David, that under existing law, it's totally okay to log a native forest where there is endangered species.
And that's the point, isn't it? That under the existing law, there's an exemption for regional forestry
that's
agreements.
That's right.
Surely
that's...
this, even if it's 3 years to transition, is an improvement.
Well, look, I mean, this is why we will kick the tyres on this and we'll look at it.
But would you vote to an improvement for native forests?
Well, I think we will have to get to the details and make sure it actually is. You know, the devil's always in the details, so we'll have a good look at this, we'll kick the tyres on it. But let me say, I have been crystal clear with the minister that we need protections for native forests. I've said it publicly, I've said it privately, I've said it repeatedly. So the fact that they've put this on the table today is a good sign that they're starting to listen. But there's plenty of other things in this bill too that need fixing. And what was tabled in the parliament is actually a step backwards from the status quo.
So explain
it doesn't include native forests.
Why is it a step backwards from the current legislation?
One of the most egregious parts of this package is that it fast-tracks coal and gas projects. So under the current law, coal and gas projects are treated the same as everything else. There's a process that you go through. Under this proposal from Labor, coal and gas projects could be approved within 30 days, fast-tracked, sped up, accelerated.
But they
at the exact time when we actually have to be reducing emissions, doing more for climate action.
But they would also have to comply, those projects, coal and gas and everything else, with the new national environmental standards, which they currently don't.
Coal and gas projects have to apply by... their applications are assessed under the existing law, just like anything else. Mm. Forestry is carved out. Salmon farming in Tasmania is carved out. Mm. Land clearing in places like Queensland is carved out.
And again, these new laws would introduce these national environment standards for all of these things. To come to this point that it's worse than what we've currently got. Mm. I mean, Ken Henry has a very different view on this. Even before the latest concessions the government's offered you, he's been urging the parliament to get behind this. New national environment standards, an EPA, which we don't currently have, as a cop on the beat, as it's called, tougher penalties for environmental breaches. Surely this is better than the current laws we
have. Well, the problem is, David, is that the existing law is riddled with holes, loopholes and get-out clauses. What the government's put on the table doesn't close any of those, puts more in, and allows coal and gas to be fast-tracked. So the government's talking about wanting to speed up approvals for renewables and housing. But what they're not saying is that this also speeds up approvals for coal and gas, for fossil fuels. So not only have they refused to work with the Greens on putting in place a climate trigger or putting in place considerations of the pollution that these coal and gas mines make, both here in Australia and overseas, but they're actually allowing them to put the foot on the accelerator, and that needs to be stopped.
But don't
that would be a terrible step backwards.
But don't decisions need to be made more speedily? I mean, take a look at this. This is the renewables rollout at the moment and the long delays in this graph from RenewMat. At the moment, battery projects taking, I think it's 14 months. This is the mean time it takes to approve a battery project. Something like 16 months for solar, 34 months for a wind project, an onshore wind project. Some of them, as Ken Henry has pointed out, can take up to 9 years to approve. We're not going to achieve net zero by 2050 under the current laws, are we?
Well, and we're not going to achieve net zero if we continue destroying our native forests either. So we and rampant land clearing.
But again, there's an improvement on offer.
But let me be clear, David, we're not going to get to net zero if we keep opening new coal and gas mines. And under this under these rules that have been tabled by the government, they want to allow them to be sped up. There's a reason that companies like Chevron, BHP, Santos are all backing what the government tabled. They want this because they know, alongside renewables, they think they're going to be able to be in the fast lane. My view is that would be a terrible step backwards.
Well, a fast lane for either a quicker yes or a quicker no is the point here.
Except that this is a government that has approved 32 coal and gas projects since they came to government, right? Five since the election, since May. So I've got no hope that they're going to be getting fast no's. I think they'll be getting fast yeses unless we keep them in the slow lane.
OK, but you would get, as Ken Henry points out, a new EPA, new environmental standards. Government's now offering you a transition on native forest logging. Are you really willing to make the perfect the enemy of the good here?
Look, no. What we want to make sure is that there is a package that genuinely protects nature and puts that protection front and centre. What the government has tabled so far doesn't do that. So they do need to work with us to try and fix it and improve it. And I'm up for that. I met with the minister on the weekend. We're working hard on this. But also Labor have to pick a side here. You know, I listened to the commentary before this interview, and you know, on one hand they're saying, oh, they're willing to work, get a deal done with the coalition that fast-tracks coal and gas, that makes life easier for coal and gas, that doesn't stop rampant land clearing, that doesn't stop the destruction of our native forests, right? They're happy to do that. But then on the other hand, they're saying, oh, we'll work with the Greens to fix all these things. What does Labor actually want? What is the objective? What is the objectives of this law? It should be about protecting our environment and protecting our climate.
So where is it at now for you, just before we leave this issue? What's the red line that you still are holding? What does the government need to do to get your vote?
Well, we definitely want to make sure that we are protecting native forests and ensuring that that is done.
But you've welcomed the progress on that.
Well, I'm absolutely welcoming the progress. But we have to kick the tyres to see if that really does make the difference it needs to. We also want to make sure that we're not seeing coal and gas, fossil fuel projects accelerated. We wanted to see these projects assessed for the climate damage that they do, the damage that their carbon pollution has on the environment. And the government is being stubborn about that. I mean, I think it's crazy. 2025, you're talking about a new set of environment laws and it doesn't even consider the climate pollution that a coal or gas mine takes in, makes.
Just to be clear for people on that, it wouldn't be considered as part of the approval process, but climate emissions and mitigation plans would have to be submitted as part of a reporting requirement. That's a new transparency measure that's not there at the moment.
So we've pushed the government to at least do require some disclosure of the amount of pollution that coal and gas mines will make. Mind you, they won't admit what the big pollution is, what's called Scope 3, when it's burnt offshore. That's where the big damage is done. But then I ask the question, if you're going to disclose and be upfront about the amount of pollution, even just here in Australia, that these mines create, that you stop the minister being able to consider that in whether he decides to approve or knock back a minor. It does seem a bit crazy.
Okay. Again,
it's like going to the bank and saying, the bank says, oh, we want all your statements, we want to know how much you earn, what you spend before you apply for a loan, and then they're not allowed to look at it. Okay. I mean, it's kind of crazy.
But once again, it's something that's not there at the moment at all. There's no requirement at all at the moment. This would be an improvement from your perspective.
Well, it would be a disclosure of the pollution. Okay. But the question is, what's that for, if not to give some direction to the minister or to the EPA that this is damaging pollution and it's going to be damaging for the environment?
Let's turn to Australia's decision to withdraw its bid for the COP climate summit next year. Turkey will host instead. You've called this outcome a failure of diplomacy and a failure of domestic leadership from the Albanese government. What could it have done to convince Turkey to pull out?
Look, I think it's really disappointing to see Australia not be able to secure this bid. And as a South Australian, I was very keen to see Adelaide host this COP. But I don't think the diplomatic effort was put in. I think the government at a federal level was pretty half-hearted about this. I mean, it seems to be an open secret amongst those close to this, that there were people within DFAT and senior members of the government who didn't want this because of the pressure that it would bear on Australia in relation to our fossil fuel exports.
OK, but coming back to the question, the government did manage to win over everyone except for Turkey. What could it have done? What should it have done to force out Turkey?
Well, look, I think there could have been, of course, an ability to convince who knows what Australia put on the table. I'm told Australia wasn't prepared to offer Turkey much at all.
So, do you mean they should have offered money?
Well, these things are about negotiation. And if you've got most of the world saying Australia should have hosted the COP and yet Australia pulls out, abandons not just...
To be clear, are you saying we should have bought off Turkey?
No, I'm saying that there are diplomatic ways that you could negotiate and try and see what kind of arrangement you could get to with Turkey.
Right.
And in previous years, governments have had to do all sorts of things. But did Australia try everything? I don't believe they did, David. And I don't believe they did because they were under pressure from the fossil fuel industry for Australia not to host it.
What about Chris Bowen? He gets this job of president for negotiations. Is that significant in your view, and can he handle both that and his current role?
Oh, I've seen some of the commentary about whether Chris Bowen can do both jobs. I think, women do it every day. We work at home and we work at work, so, I'm not too worried about that. But I think this is, at least has Australia involved at some level, and I think that's a good thing.
OK. Final one, social media age limit that's coming in a few weeks. The aim here, of course, is to stop powerful tech giants exploiting kids with addictive social media that can have real harm to their well-being. You've opposed this from the outset, though. Have any of the pleas from parents or children to support this influenced you at all?
Look, I really understand the desperation of parents on this. And as someone who's had teenagers and understand the power that social media can have over not just young people, but all of us. I mean, I bet you're a bit of a doom scroller when you let yourself kind of get lost in it, David.
I'm off social media. It's good for my health.
But the problem here is, this isn't forcing the social media companies to actually be safe, to actually clean up their act. It bans young people from being able to be on it, only up to the age of 16, of course, and then it's a free-for-all. So it doesn't clean up any of those damaging elements, the dangerous algorithms, the insidious targeting of advertising that uses people's own data to then force advertising down their throats. There are things that can be done to force legally companies like the big social media companies to be legally required to be safe for all users. Because I'm worried that what happens here is that some young people will be, thrown off the system and therefore, parents will work with them. I'm worried about the kids who fall through the cracks, either are still on there when they shouldn't be, based on the age, or find themselves in even darker places on the internet. And I think that is a real risk. Putting in place a kind of false sense of protection doesn't make our children safer,
but again,
and it doesn't make these platforms safer for everybody. Mm. You know, I think one of the things that Australia should do is ban digital advertising for anyone under 18. You shouldn't be able to scrape... These companies shouldn't be able to scrape young people's data and then target them with advertising. If that was in place, these social media companies wouldn't care about having to have young people.
And look,
it hits them at their business model.
That's an interesting suggestion, but once again, are you at risk of making the perfect the enemy of the good by opposing what many would argue will help a lot of kids?
Look, the law's in place, right? It starts on December 10. It's happening. My concern is what happens on December 10 when young people fall through the cracks, work their way around it. I mean, I don't know about your kids, but I know, you know, my daughter and her friends would have easily been able to get around this. They're smart kids.
That's certainly true. That's certainly true. But let me ask you this finally. Are you encouraging kids come December 10 to get off social media or stay on social media?
Look, I think we need to make sure they're in places that are safe. And if they are not safe, then encourage young people to find other ways to connect.
So should they get off social media or not?
Well, if you're under 16, that's the law, that you shouldn't be on these platforms. My concern is making sure that kids can work with parents to ensure that where they are online, because this isn't kicking kids off the internet, let's be honest, right? You can be in a logged out mode through an internet browser, and it's a free for all. So that's going to be the issue here.
That's still
how do parents work with their children to make sure when they're online, whether it's through a social media app or on the internet, that they're actually safe? And I'm worried that we've given parents a false sense of security, and the government's going to have to do more. A digital duty of care, requiring these companies to legally have to provide safe spaces and stopping them at their business model. Why should they be able to advertise and target our children? And these companies get off on this stuff, and we need to hold them to account.
Sarah Hanson-Young, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Coming up, we will have more on that COP decision. Can Chris Bowen juggle these new responsibilities of being the President for Negotiation as well as the Minister for Climate Change and Energy? Let's get back to our panel though first. We're joined once more by Nikki Sava, Tom Crowley and Mark Kenny. Just to come back to the EPBC, the Environment Law Negotiation, Nikki, listening to the Senator there, obviously some welcome of the offer that's been made, but still some issues. Does that suggest to you the government should have more hope about a deal with the Greens?
Well, there is obviously room for negotiation, and while you're still talking and negotiating, there's always the potential for agreement. I mean, I think there seems to be a certain amount of goodwill on both sides there.
Yeah.
There are obviously sticking points over forestry, but from, you know, where we sit here, I can't see why those issues can't be resolved.
Yeah, Tom, what do you think? Is it looking more likely a deal with the Greens, do you think?
I think it's sort of evenly placed. I mean, I think it was a point well made in that interview that when you're offering something significant to the Greens and you're offering something significant to the Coalition and they are at odds with one another, it does leave open the question of what exactly does the government want. And I think over the course of this, over a year or two, I've heard confident proclamations in both directions. The government wants to do this with the Greens. The government wants to do this with the Coalition. We don't know truly what their preference between the two is, but it does leave a bit of an uncomfortable position if this bill passes and you put something, for example, for forests on the table as just a bargaining chip, and then you pass a bill without it because the Coalition presumably won't support the forestry dimension. That part of it is uncomfortable. Having said that, I think the traps have been well laid. I think both the Coalition and the Greens have reasons to think that voters will want them to appear pragmatic on this, whether Susan Lee's right flank is actually willing to do that, especially when March is the easy exit strategy. Bridget McKenzie and others can just say, well, what's the rush? Let's get to the end of the week and not pass it. Mm. I think the politics are probably trickier for her in a sense than the Greens. It's an interesting one.
I don't know, but for the Greens though, Mark, they'd be voting no to something to help native forests, something with an EPA, higher environmental standards.
And they... exactly. Excuse me. And they would be allowing the Coalition to be the major sort of shaper outside the government of the final bill, the final law, rather than themselves, right? And we know the sort of heat that they took over stopping the CPRS. If we roll right back to, you know, you and I were at COP what was it, COP15
in Copenhagen. That's right, a long time ago.
One of the most famous COPs because it failed so much. But
also a logistical nightmare. It was. We won't relive all of
that. It was. When we think about COP in Adelaide, we think back to a queue to get in that took the whole of the first day when we were there. And, you know, we eventually abandoned
it. We had to abandon it for the cold.
We had to abandon it for the cold. And I think Karen Middleton ended up waiting in the queue and still didn't get in, even though she was in sort of similar place to us.
So, hypothermia.
Yeah, so, I mean, these things are a huge undertaking.
Yeah,
it's another issue. But I do think on the question of, you know, whether they go to the government, whether they go to the coalition or whether they go to the Greens, Sarah Hanson-Young's point is a point well made, I think. You know, what is it that the government wants here? I suspect it wants to do a deal with the coalition, as it did on the
anti-crime. I mean, Jim Chalmers has said that. The Treasurer has said that.
Yeah.
Want to keep it in the party of
there's
government.
There's a sort of a sovereign risk sort of orthodoxy argument that, you know, if you do a deal with the coalition, they've backed the law, therefore investors, you know, in projects know that the law isn't going to dramatically change if there's a change of government.
Yeah.
But it is an Environmental Protection Act, right? I mean, that's its actual primary purpose. So,
And Labor's left flank is worth watching here as well. They can't give away too much to do a deal with the coalition or upset their own left flank as well. Let's talk about the COP meeting. Enough reminiscing about the old ones that we went to. Next year's one will be in Turkey. Now, Chris Bowen ends up with this role. Well, let's hear him describe what he'll be doing.
I would have all the powers of the COP presidency to manage, to handle the negotiations, to appoint co-facilitators, to prepare draft text, to issue the cover decision.
Nikki, that sounds like a big job for someone who's also going to remain the Minister for Climate and Energy.
That sounds like more than a full-time job, doesn't it? And although the Prime Minister has said, you know, he's sure that Chris can do it, you know, on his ear.
You bet he can, he said.
You bet he can. There's a bit more doubt inside the government about whether that is actually feasible or desirable.
What are you picking up there?
That they're speculating internally that Bowen might have to quit the ministry to devote himself full-time to COP. And then that would necessitate, obviously, a reshuffle.
So this, Chris Bowen, to be clear, is saying, no, I'm fine, I can do it all. But this opens an interesting hypothetical, doesn't it? If Bowen were to go, what happens?
Well, there would have to be a reshuffle, which is something that prime ministers hate, because once they start reshuffling, they start creating more and more enemies. But the person, you know, who is being talked about as possibly being elevated into the cabinet would be someone like Andrew Charlton.
Also from the New South Wales, right? A neat fix.
A neat fix. And, you know, a very competent guy who's very familiar with the area and would be bound to do a good job. But I think probably what they hope is that they will give it a try for a few months and see how it goes. And if it's obviously not working, then something will have to happen.
I mean, Ed Husic might also have a claim on after copying one for the team.
It's a bit of a weird idea, this, though, the proposition that he would quit the ministry. I mean, this is, what, a one-year job, effectively, to the conference?
I think it depends on what it's going to look like. I mean, you hear Bowen's description there and it sounds like Turkey is just putting out the flower arrangements on the tables and doing the catering and Bowen's doing the rest. And if that is the case, then I think there's a lot to be settled on that. But that is a big job. So when Alok Sharma did this for Glasgow, he was a politician and he did leave Parliament. He went all around the world. He visited, I think, 50 countries. There were all sorts of international trips. It's an important job. It's easy to dismiss these things as gab fests. But, you know, to be able to even get words into these sorts of agreements requires all sorts of careful diplomacy. And the leader of the negotiations is significant in that. So it's a worthy thing for a climate minister to spend their time doing. But the biggest domestic energy debate is about power prices. The government has already started dropping out little bits and pieces trying to combat this power prices argument. They are taking seriously what the coalition is going to be saying on that. So if you've got the minister who is most associated with power prices, who's showing up in the Bahamas, showing up in Norway, showing up in Japan, trying to broker something for an international deal, the coalition will say every single week, where's Chris Bowen today while your power bills are going up?
Well, and even this coalition in the shape it's in should at least be able to manage to run some line of attack.
Well, Susan Lee's already running the line. Here she was.
Australians don't need a part-time energy minister. They need an energy minister who's focused on their bills. So while Chris Bowen is managing an international schedule, globe-trotting around the world, Australians are trying to manage their household bills in the lead-up to Christmas.
And you can just see how that line is going to sink in. I mean, maybe you can do 2 a.m. Zoom calls around the world and do it that way.
Just think Anthony Albanese's approach to politics and to cauterising issues like that, I really just can't see him allowing that line to go on.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. And this is a unique situation given Turkey is the host, but he's the man in charge of negotiations, so we'll see how it plays out. But anyway, let's talk about the Liberal Party. It's a big week coming up for Susan Lee, but it is a dangerous time to be a Liberal leader, and I want to just look at what's happened at the state level. The two biggest divisions for the party, Victoria, New South Wales, both just chucked out the blokes. In come women as leaders, and they're both first-termers, Jess Wilson in Victoria, Kelly Sloan in New South Wales. And notably, both of them have immediately said they're sticking with their net zero emissions target.
There's no plans to change what legislation has gone through the parliament. But what we are doing is we are saying we have to focus on the fact that power bills keep increasing.
Around net zero. OK, yeah, no change, no change. We had a party room meeting this week and there was strong support to maintain our existing position.
Mark, that's notable, isn't it?
It is.
I mean, there's a lot to be said about putting first-termers in and why they've done it. But just on that policy that they both immediately said no, we're sticking with it.
Well, state governments are closer to the people. They're closer to, you know, service delivery, and that's the message they're very strongly picking up. Mark Speakman, the person that Kelly Sloan replaced as opposition leader in New South Wales, talked about brand damage. I mean, this is what I think Liberals who are closer to the ground are feeling all around the country.
Of course they are.
I think Basil Zemplis in WA is pro-net zero as well. So I think, you know, it's not all that surprising, it just shows that the conservative side of politics is very divided on this question, and it was quite a controversial decision for the coalition to walk away from it, bearing in mind that it was Scott Morrison who legislated it, who went to COP in Scotland and pledged Australia's commitment.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing, Nikki, Susan Lee and the Liberals federally might think they've settled it, but clearly at the state level they have not. It just keeps coming back to this question. What does it mean to be a Liberal today?
I don't think anybody knows, really. They have an identity crisis. They have an existential crisis. We are watching the Liberal Party disintegrating before our eyes. Anybody who thinks that the net zero issue is finally settled inside the federal coalition, I think, is having themselves on. I think that will continue to play out and probably still have quite serious repercussions. I mean, when I was talking to people for my book, which is out tomorrow.
We're about to talk about the book. There it is. Hold it up for us. Earthquake.
There was not a single person who was able to say with confidence that the coalition would not split again and that the Liberal Party would hold together. Hmm. Not one. They all allowed for the possibility that it might. Andrew Hastie, for instance, believes that a split is possible, not inevitable. He also thinks it's possible that the Liberal Party will become extinct because...
Andrew Hastie.
Andrew Hastie. That's what he said to me. Andrew Hastie's ambition ultimately is to recreate or resurrect the Mencian Liberal Party. But what's happened right now is that the Liberal Party has lost its progressive base with the loss of all the teal seats and its conservative base is fragmenting. They are losing votes every day, hand over fist, to One Nation, and even the National Party is doing better than them. So he sees as his first priority the consolidation of the Conservative base. After that, you know, his hope is that he will reach an accommodation with the moderates. And that is what he would like to do. I mean, he knows that the only way the Liberal Party can survive is with those two wings operating together. So he wants to bring them together. Question is, will he row so far out that he won't be able to come back? And it's not going to be easy. The way things are at the moment with polarisation and with the divisions, to reconcile those two things.
So. As far as what happens this week, though, in the coming week, the final week of Parliament for the year, Andrew Hastie, Angus Taylor, nobody's planning any sort of move. Liberals are all, you know, saying no, unless there's, you know, some unforeseen further blunder or disaster, or indeed a news poll that's expected tonight that's even worse for them than the already diabolical poll numbers they've got. Susan Lee should survive this week. But it is interesting, I've also detected, you know, some saying Andrew Hastie probably needs to move sooner rather than later if he's going to move, because things might change next year.
Well, this is the thing. Right. This is the thing. One of the things that's protecting Susan Lee is that no one knows who would win if there was a leadership battle, right? Because obviously you've got Angus Taylor and Andrew Hastie who are being talked about a lot. Are they ready? Is it the right time? There's a lot of other factors as well, like, you know, what would be the transaction cost of knocking off the first female leader of the party after just 6 months?
Terrible. But
the very fact that she's got that on her side, and she's got essentially two potential competitors who are not sure of each other and who are both from the right of the party, I think that makes it pretty impractical that something's going to suddenly precipitate, you know, this week.
It can equally, in a way, in a sense, that could also hasten it, in the sense that once you've made a decision that a leader is going to go at some point, then you start jostling and going, well, when's my moment to make sure the future goes my way? Which is true for the moderates as well, who will be eyeing off positions like shadow treasurer, etc. Yeah. That's that dangerous environment we're in. I think the real challenge, though, for everyone, and I think this is probably where Susan Lee's failure has come internally, is they've got to find an idea that they can all galvanise around. We know that on net zero and on immigration, there are just really, really sharp differences within the party. In immigration, we're seeing this already. Susan Lee's saying just about infrastructure, but there are people on the right saying, no, it's about Australian values, it's about particular migrants. That's another thorny one. They need probably an economic policy, I think, that's a big bang idea, that they all feel excited, they all feel like Liberals, and that actually resonates with voters. I'm not sure that there's one obviously sitting on the table. Nikki, you discussed in your book bracket creep indexing, tax brackets. That's one that always looms in the background. Something big like that.
You know what
that.
They need? They know what they need? Another glossy brochure, because in case you've missed it, over the past week, Susan Lee did a whopping 40-something interviews, and, yeah, she did have a handy prop along the way.
Our affordable energy plan.
It's terrific to lead a team which is united behind our energy plan.
I'm talking about my affordable, responsible energy plan.
You may have heard about the plan I've been working on.
The thing that matters most today, which is our affordable energy plan.
I am 100% committed to the plan that I'm talking about. Affordable energy and responsible emissions reduction.
Right now, we're all talking about this plan. Energy is number one.
Nobody has a clue what the plan is. They know there's a brochure.
But she's on message. She's on message. Albanese had his Medicare card. Susan Lee's got the energy plan. Problem is the plan itself, I suppose.
The plan itself. You know, what does it do? Nobody knows. It's internally inconsistent. And, you know, just going back to Susan Lee, yes, she will undoubtedly be safe this week unless, you know, she makes another stupid mistake, which is always on the cards. One of the things that is protecting her at the moment is the fact that she is a woman. And if she was a bloke, I think, and there was a bad poll this week, they would just go in and remove them. So they will allow her to stay for a few months next year to give her more time to show that maybe she can, you know, lift them in the polls. But there is no confidence that that is going to happen, and that she will almost certainly be gone by the middle of the year.
The book, Nikki, congratulations on Earthquake. It's just been released. I haven't read the whole thing, but the parts that I did read yesterday, going to where things went wrong for Dutton in the election campaign, it's quite a list. I think you're quite fair to Peter Dutton in the way that you do acknowledge, you know, his attributes, the fact that the real Peter Dutton probably wasn't always seen, you note. But you did also write a rather frank assessment. You say that he was a man out of his depth, incapable of producing policies on his own while refusing to empower his front benches to deliver them. And you quote some of his front benches saying, "We didn't have a message for anyone, nothing about policy, no real cost of living measures, no big vision, no narrative. He wasn't up to the job." Tell us what you concluded about Peter Dutton.
Well, that about covers it, I think. Look, there was obviously a lot of mistrust in the upper echelons of the Liberal Party, and Dutton did not trust his ministers to come up with decent policies. The only people that he relied upon for advice were in his office, and they were not up to the job. There was a breakdown of trust between Dutton and campaign headquarters. I mean, I do describe what happened on tax indexation. Mm. There was a proposal that was worked up for tax indexation to be released at the policy launch. But Dutton dithered about it. Everybody who was on the Dutton plane opposed it. Everybody who was on campaign headquarters supported it. In the end, Dutton decided not to go with it. And then a week later, he floats it as an option in a newspaper interview, seemingly out of nowhere.
And also the decision to oppose the government's tax cut. You go into some detail on that and how dismayed his colleagues were. But I think a lot of people will be wondering, what did you conclude on Susan Lee? What did you find out about Susan Lee?
Well, I do say in the discussion in the lock-up, she tried to appeal to both sides of the street.
On the tax cut?
On the tax cut. On the one hand, agreeing with Dutton that more money needed to be spent on defence, and on the other with Jane Hume, who was saying we need to spend more on cost of living. So the point that came through there, and also comes out through the book, is that she never actually stood up for anything. She never staked out any territory. She never, you know, fought for anything. And that has continued in the leadership.
She would say as deputy leader, though, that she had a job to try and unite the party, and she had a job to support the leader, presumably. Would that be her response to that?
Maybe it was, but she wouldn't speak to me for the book. But the other criticism of her colleagues was that she made herself invisible during the campaign, and she spent a lot of time in seats where it was most likely she would secure votes after the election.
Okay.
There was a lot of criticism of her that she was leaking and undermining and also scouring for votes amongst backbenchers and even frontbenchers for the vote after the election, because she was sure they were going to lose.
Geez, it's a happy bunch by the sounds of it. Look, we're nearly out of time. Just very quickly, Mark, I did want to mention the CSIRO job cuts this week. Another 350 or up to 350 to go on top of 800 that have gone over the last 18 months. Government's defending what it's doing here, but what has this told us about its priorities for science?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. As you point out in a piece you've got, I think, on the ABC website, there's a lot of support for other industries where there are blue-collar jobs that are going. The government often steps in and protects jobs, but we don't see that happening with the university sector and with the CSIRO. What it says about the clever country, what it says about the history of the CSIRO, in terms of its long-term implications for economic productivity and innovation. I mean, I think it's a pretty telling sort of moment. And
yeah, as someone said to me for that piece, we don't know what we're losing. It's the ideas, the innovation, the new industries and jobs that these guys come up with. Let's get some final observations. Mark.
Look, just back on the point about the Liberal Party and splitting and so forth, we tend to think of splits in terms of the way they've happened in history. Perhaps a way of looking at it is that the Liberal Party's already split. When we look at the Parliament, most those seats that it used to hold are now held by moderate teals. And of course, as Nikki says, it's absolutely bleeding support to the right, and we see that in all of the polls. So perhaps this process is already underway, and because we're seeing it for the first time, we're not really recognising it. And just quickly on Ukraine, it seems like Trump has again flipped against Zelensky, and we now see, I think, what is potentially one of history's great betrayals playing out with Trump basically insisting that Ukraine accept a deal which really offers no penalty to Russia and legitimises its unlawful take of taking of a significant part of Ukrainian territory, and neuters Ukraine's ability to even defend itself after that or to get membership of NATO or anything else. I mean, it's an utterly terrible deal, and it just shows Trump cannot be relied upon. He's flipped and flopped on this several times, but in the end, he's come out for Putin, and that's what we always thought he'd do.
Tom.
Ted O'Brien will speak at the press club this week. I understand there'll be a bit of a focus on bracket creep. Comes after he also gave a speech talking about super being Australians' money. So maybe a couple of little signs laid there of where some policy directions might go if he remains the shadow treasurer. And in the meantime, Jim Chalmers preparing MyEFO, sending signals that it'll be a pretty slim document.
Nikki.
OK, so just one little anecdote from the book. Out of the blue on March 14, Susan Lee contacted Jane Hume to arrange a catch-up in Melbourne, and this was just before the election was called. They were never bosom buddies, and Jane was a bit, you know, nonplussed about why this should be happening. Anyway, it became clear to Jane during the conversation that Susan was actually sussing her out about her vote for the leadership after the election. And Jane remained non-committal, which could help explain why she is still on the backbench. And just one other little observation. The South Australian election is on in March, and Liberals fear a massacre there and, in fact, are worried that they could be reduced to zero seats in the state parliament. So if that were to happen, that would be a massive blow for the Liberal Party and would also be a mortal blow to Susan Lee.
A complete wipeout in South Australia. Let's see. Thank you all very much for joining us this morning. Finally, I thought we could end the show with all of us performing the Taylor Swift dance craze that's all over social media.
I've got a jet, actually, David.
I saw back. Okay. No, I had a better idea, actually. Let's watch the Prime Minister's effort instead. We'll leave you with that. Thanks for watching.
You're making us all feel very excited about being here.